Today, who are the Mangrove Nine and why don't more of us know their story? The Mangrove in Notting Hill, London, was a restaurant that in the 1960s became well known for West Indian food and political discussions. It also became a target for the police, who frequently raided it. Eventually, some in the community took to the streets to protest against what they saw as continual harassment. But instead, they found themselves arrested and charged with inciting a riot. What happened next became a landmark moment in British history, although one that many people have never heard of. And that is why Oscar-winning director Steve McQueen has turned this story into a film to mark its 50th anniversary. In it, there is a moment depicting the height of the protest against police harassment, where a large group of black activists came face to face with officers.
This attack on a black establishment is not an isolated event, but a sustained campaign against black people. And today we are saying, enough is enough!
It's a scene that has really stuck with The Guardian's Lanry Bakary.
As I was watching it, you know, I went to some of the Black Lives Matter protests this summer, and there are obviously echoes of that. You know, it's still about racism. It's still about the police not doing the job that they're supposed to be. It's stop and search. It's similar stuff that the people in the 60s and the 70s were protesting, and we're still talking about that today, 50 years later. That's the main thing that stuck with me after seeing that scene.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the true story of the Mangrove Nine. Lanry Bakary, you're The Guardian's arts and culture correspondent, and we're going to talk about this period of history involving a group called the Mangrove Nine in the late 1960s, who were activists whose protests against the police would lead them into an extraordinary legal case. They used to meet in Notting Hill. There were clearly tensions around race in the area at the time. What was going on?
Yeah, so I think this was a stronghold of the White Defence League and other fascist organisations like Oswald Mosley's Union Movement. It wasn't a safe place for black people, but they lived there because the rent was cheap. And, you know, they were told to come over. You know, we all know the story of the Windrush, in order to work in Britain and help rebuild it, and were fed this kind of image of Britain as this welcoming place where they'd be able to get on and do well and serve the mother country, but also, you know, make a life for themselves. And when they got here and they were dropped into Notting Hill, people were being murdered, people were being killed, people were being maimed, teddy boys were fighting them, and the police were hostile. So, it's a very different world to the one that we know now.
I first became associated with the Notting Hill area in 1969.
Jeb Johnson describes himself as a Windrush baby.
I was 17 years of age, politically hungry. I had just read the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was one of my inspirations to get involved with community and black community politics. Black Power was very active in the States.
And in London too, Jeb found a community of activists among the people who he remembers sitting beside and listening to were names that might sound familiar today. Darcus Howe and his partner Barbara Beese, Althea Jones LeQuant and Rodan Gordon. They used to meet at a place called Backer Yard.
They were bright, young people of Caribbean origin in Trinidad. They were fighting for the rights of the natives, I believe, at the time. So they were already politicized when we met them. They were always in there and they were always discussing issues. They would be discussing Trinidad. They would be discussing racism in the United Kingdom. So it was a natural gravitas for young people like myself who were interested and becoming interested in politics.
Afterwards, the group would often continue their discussions at a nearby West Indian restaurant called the Mangrove, owned by a man called Frank Critchlow.
I believe that it was called the Mangrove because the concept of the mangrove is a swamp, And in the swamp, if you envisage a mangrove, there were all sorts of animals, but they all coexisted. And I think that was the concept of the mangrove, in my opinion. Anybody who was left wing at the time, you frequented the mangrove.
Like who? Who did you see in there?
I saw Vanessa Redgrave in there. I saw Trevor Carter in there. I saw Bob Marley in there.
You saw Bob Marley? What was that like?
That was quite awe-ish, you know, sitting in the mangrove, Bob Marley eating rice with butter, because I believe he was a vegetarian.
Was there music? Was there dancing?
No. Frank always felt that dancing and music attracted the police.
Lanry, tell me about Frank Critchlow. Why was he worried about the police?
So the mangrove was Frank Critchlow's second establishment. He had another place called the El Rio Cafe, which was notorious because it was named in the report into the Profumo affair as a place where Profumo and Christine Keeler would hang out. It's also the place where Christine Keeler met Lucky Gordon, who was the West Indian man she had a relationship with. And essentially, because of the way that escalated, that led to the Profumo affair happening, which was one of the biggest scandals that the country had seen at that point. So, yeah, Critchlow was maybe on the radar of the authorities, and he'd set up the mangrove restaurant as something different. It didn't want it to be a late night hangout spot. It was also like a community spot, places where people could go get advice about housing, about immigration. It was a real kind of centre of the community, and Frank Critchlow, you know, became this kind of huge figure.
From speaking to people who often visited Mangrove and knew Frank, it sounded like he just wanted to get on with running his restaurant in peace. He wasn't particularly aiming to be an activist.
Yeah, so Frank wasn't someone who particularly wanted to be an activist, but he was hanging around with people who absolutely were, you know, Darkus Howe, Althea Jones-Laquan, Barbara Beast. These were all people who were involved in the formation of the Black British Panthers, which obviously was a radical organisation that was interested in looking after and supporting Black people in Britain through a kind of Marxist lens. And Frank was very much adjacent to that and then became kind of caught up in it just through the events of what happened in the late 60s in West London.
What happened was that Frank Critchlow and the mangrove became a relentless target for the police.
It was raided 12 times between January 1969 and July 1970, which is a hell of a lot of times for the police to be raiding an establishment and not finding anything.
For those inside the mangrove, when the police entered, it could be terrifying, as Jeb remembers.
Basically, the police would just kick down the door, run in the place, search everybody. I think one of the most disturbing things was that people who were buying takeaways, they would search the people's takeaways, and that often made the food inedible.
And that's something that's really striking in the film. There's a whole section where you just see these raids, and it's just bang, 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 bang.
After the raids on the restaurant, people in the community started to say enough was enough, didn't they? Tell me what happened next.
Yeah, so Darkus Howe and Althea Jones-Laquan suggested to Critchlow that they should organise a protest. They would go to various police stations and they would protest against the harassment of the mangrove. So as well as slogans like hands off black people, it was also hands off the mangrove. Leave this place in the community alone. It's really important to us and we've had enough. Then you have a process which is organised. 150 West Indians from all over London, and they head out on the street and they're met with more than 500 police officers. So it gives you a sense of like the disproportionate response by the police. And all these people were doing was expressing the democratic right to go out there and say, stop harassing us. And there are different interpretations of what happened on the day. Some of the protesters say it was the police grabbing signs out of people's hands and snapping them and being aggressive and getting into the crowd. Other witnesses said it was people in the crowd throwing bricks at the police that started it. But either way, there's a load of arrests. Quite a lot of police officers are injured. And then ultimately it leads to people being charged with affray and rioting, amongst other offences. So yeah, it was a real kind of pitch battle in the streets by the sound of it. There are some photographs from it which look pretty horrific. And it's just in a kind of quiet West London street. And Darkus Howe at the protest himself, I mean, he was kind of coming into himself as a young kind of intellectual thinker, activist. You know, he was stood on a car at one point in the protest and he starts to give this speech.
It has been for some time now that black people have been caught up in complaining to police about police Yeah. Complaining to magistrates about magistrates. Complaining to judges about judges.
And they wanted to really hold a lens up to these people and put them on trial and say, you aren't doing your job.
We have become the own shapers of our destiny as from today.
So you can see the importance of that speech today. It was used by Kano on his Mercury Prize nominated album, Hoodies All Summer. There's a track called Teardrops, and on that he samples the Dark As How speech.
We've complained to the police about the police and nothing's been done. We've complained to judges about judges and nothing's been done. Now it's time to do something ourselves.
And yeah, I think he's making a pretty simple point there. He's drawing the parallels between what was going on then and the situation that we're in now.
Jeb, you knew Darkus well. What was he like? And what about Barbara and the others?
Darkus was live. He was vibrant. He was bright. He was articulate. Barbara Bees was our United Kingdom Angela Davis. And at 17, I think I might have had a secret crush on her that she probably never even found out about. I think today might, when if she hears this, that would be the first time she probably knows this.
It's not too late. What about Althea?
Althea, very strong black woman, very Afrocentric. That was evident in her attire. She was always resplendent, as I recall, in African cloths and garments.
What ended up happening that day?
So there were special branch officers on the march as well, taking an interest in these black radicals. Pictures were taken of people who were on the protest. And I think it was a few weeks later, arrests were made of the nine people who would become the Mangrove Nine. And they were to be tried at the Old Bailey, which is pretty extraordinary when you think about it. I mean, the Old Bailey is a place where murderers are tried. And it was seen very much as a way for the police to try and intimidate these, as they would see it, kind of black radicals. They had something called the Black Power Desk in West London, which the historian Paul Field has written about a bit. And these were officers who were dedicated to getting intelligence on people like Darkus Howell, Althea Jones-Laquan, people who were seen as radicals who could cause problems like the American radicals had.
And the way they challenged the charges against them was groundbreaking, wasn't it? Tell me what happened.
When they got to the court case, traditionally, when these things had kind of come up, you'd have your barrister who would represent you, in this case, Ian MacDonald. But they decided that Darkus Howell and Althea Jones-Laquan would represent themselves. So that was one of the tactics they used. And the idea for doing that was that you would have a black person in a British court, in a high-profile case, challenging not just the charges against them, but the very system that was trying them. So they essentially would flip the script and put the British justice system on trial. The other ways they were challenged that were pretty smart. So they used the pretty old law where you can ask to be tried by a jury of your peers. So they made the argument that the jury should be all black. That was a tactic that they used to, I think, wind up the judiciary, but also, again, just put the whole system on trial and say, OK, you want to make this about us being apparently rioting and causing a fray, but we're going to make this about you and the whole system that you have being racist.
There was this group of black people, nine of them in the box. What they were saying was the British police were liars. Now, that was a serious and unheard of accusation to make against the Metropolitan Police. So they took a stance and it worked.
It worked, not just because of the decision to take on the system of justice itself, but because of Darkus meticulously challenging the prosecution's evidence.
You know, he was quoting Shakespeare in court and pulling apart the defence's argument. The officers involved were saying that we saw all you people do this, this and this. And Darkus Howell just asked a very simple question. All right, well, where were you when you saw it? And they said, oh, we're in the back of this Black Mariah, this observation van. And he got the measurements for the little slot that they would have looked out of. And it was tiny. It was like a letterbox. And they were saying that three of them saw the same thing at the same time, which was patently ridiculous. So he just, by using his intellect, and Althea Jones-Laquan did similar things, they just completely pulled apart the police's argument and made them look ridiculous. All of them, one by one, were found not guilty of the most serious charges. Five of the nine were acquitted on all charges against them, and the other four, which were Rupert Boyce, Ronan Gordon, Anthony Innes, and Althea Jones-Laquan, they received suspended sentences for a selection of lesser offences, including affray and assaulting police officers. And the thing which I think really moved the needle, or the thing that people talked about and still do, is the summing up by the judge, Edward Clark, who said, what this trial has shown is that there is clearly evidence of racial hatred on both sides. You know, that was the first judicial acknowledgement of racism in the Met. And that was a massive moment, not just for the people on trial, but for people in the courtroom, for people outside of the courtroom, because it was an acknowledgement of something that they knew was real. You know, in the same way that, you know, with the McPherson report, the idea of the Met being institutionally racist, it was just an acknowledgement that this has happened. It finally gave credence to something that people have been talking about for decades.
The trial had caused shockwaves for the police and for the British justice system. The individuals involved carried on with their lives through the 1970s, and for a while the mangrove seemed to be thriving. Frank Scully was a teenager then.
I got a job on a record store on Portobello Road outside a place called the Black People's Information Centre, which was run by a guy called Weldon Gordon, who was one of the Mangrove Nine. And I was always intrigued when I looked across the road to the mangrove, because the guys there, I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen so much well-dressed, vocal men in shiny shoes and shiny cars, especially on a Friday night. It was like carnival. And so I was quite in tune to a lot of the conversations. That was like my training.
The Mangrove Nine were still active, perhaps because they felt there was so much work to do.
The trial vindicated the accused and acquitted most of them, but it didn't really change policing attitudes towards the Black community.
Including towards Frank Critchlow, who continued to face intense scrutiny.
In 1979, Critchlow was charged with some other people for drug offences, which he was cleared of. He was well known as an anti-drug advocate. He pushed against them massively, so it just didn't chime with who he was.
And so in the 1970s and 80s, years after the trial that found the police had been motivated by racism, those raids continued, as Frank Scully now remembers.
I've been in the mangrove when it has been raided by the police, and it's a very harrowing scene, because, you know, they send in the riot police. It's not like the normal Bobby. It's like, you know, police with riot shields and everything. I was in a mangrove once in 1982, I think, when there was an incident outside All Saints Road. Had nothing to do with a mangrove, but I can remember the lights being turned off and the doors being shut and the police banging on the door and telling us to come up. And somebody said, no, you come down. And there was sort of a standoff for a little while. And yeah, it's very harrowing. You know, you're in the dark and you've got police torches shining down, police dogs. They've got the truncheons. And you don't know whether you're going to get hit or not.
Must have been terrifying.
Yeah, I was still a young man, so it was, for me, it was terrifying.
What happened to Frank and to the mangrove after that?
They went after Frank so much that, you know, the poor man, it must have been too much for him, because, you know, he was the figurehead, and they just kept attacking him. At one point, they got a court order banning him from All Saints Road, from the mangrove. And I think that was the beginning of the end. Once they banned him, and, you know, everything just sort of crashed.
It's just this constant harassment. It didn't stop to the point in 1992 where he actually sued the Met for false imprisonment, battery and malicious prosecution. He was awarded then, you know, a record damages of £50,000. So that's, you know, decades of continued harassment. It's not as if the Met just went, oh, okay, yeah, we've kind of learned our lesson. They doubled down, if anything. So it was something which, you know, left a mark on Frank.
Did you see Frank after that? How did he feel?
Yeah, you know, it was sad. You know, I remember seeing him on the Portobello, and I remember going to his funeral. It was beautiful. I mean, it's the biggest funeral I've ever seen in London for any person in the Black community. Hundreds of people. They walked to Kensal Green with the Mangrove Steel Band playing. It was a carnival. We were celebrating him, not mourning him. And when we was outside the mangrove, somebody said Frank was just an ordinary man doing extraordinary things. And I think that describes him in a nutshell. An ordinary man doing extraordinary things.
Coming up, We hear from Oscar-winning director Steve McQueen about why he has turned this story into a film.
Steve McQueen is one of, if not the most famous British director. He won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave. And it's him focusing on Black British life and a huge historical moment, which was seismic for the West Indian community and I suppose for all communities of colour in Britain in the 70s. And Steve McQueen's father actually was a regular at the Mangrove restaurant.
Steve had local ties. So we were pretty sure that he understood what needed to be done and moreover, that he would do it with respect and care.
Tell me about interviewing Steve McQueen.
I interviewed Steve McQueen over the telephone.
You'll now be connected to the conference.
Hi, Steve.
Hello. Hello, how are you?
It was the second time I've interviewed him this year. And he's an incredibly interesting interviewee. When you talk to him about race or race within the film industry specifically, he'll often end sentences just with fact. Or he'll say, end of.
It's important because these are national stories. These aren't local stories. These are national stories. These are stories which have helped to make the fabric of this country fact.
And you can just kind of tell that, you know, he's been asked about this stuff so many times and he's spoken out about it so many different times. I think there is a frustration there. I won't say anger, but definitely a frustration at having to be this person who does talk out a lot about it, but he understands that he needs to. Because he's got a voice like none other. His platform's absolutely massive.
Of Marlon Brando's, of Montgomery Clift's, so, you know, the building site, or driving buses, or our Catherine Hepburn's, or NIT. They were not welcomed in the British film industry. They were not welcome. That's why, in some ways, my ambition, in some ways, maybe, to fill that gap in a way, it's a bit crazy, but, you know, to make these films. Because I want to build that history hadn't been visualized or celebrated.
Is there, I mean, I'm just thinking about the last few months in this country and the discussion around the proms or the Colston statue. At the minute, a lot of cultural items are being taken and politicised. Are you worried that when this comes out, the same thing could happen with Mangrove? Because obviously these were radical Black people who were really butting up against the British establishment. And a lot of people on the right in this country will not agree with what they did. Are you worried that like that it could come into that culture war?
Culture war. This is the for me, this is the moral situation.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the thing about the Mangrove Nine is that you know, they were on the right side of history.
Mm.
So people have to decide what side of history they want to be on.
It's going to be interesting to see what the reception's going to be, because these are some stories that I think people, after watching them, will probably feel like they should know.
I mean, despite actually knowing of and reading lots from Dark as How, I had never heard specifically of the Mangrove Nine. And when I was speaking to a friend who works in criminal justice, she had never heard of them either, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? It reminds me of when we did the Bristol bus boycott piece on Today in Focus, and I realised no one had ever taught us about that either. Why do you think we weren't taught about this thing that was just so important in terms of race relations in the UK?
I mean, if you think about it, it's pretty embarrassing for the British judiciary and for institutions to have these West Indians come and completely show you up. There's all kinds of those cases where it's these massive miscarriages of justice, and that's not what we're taught about, because we're the good guys. We're not America, are we? And it's interesting, growing up, you know, I could tell you all about Rosa Parks, but I couldn't tell you about the Bristol bus boycott. I think that's a disgrace. I think that's a massive failure of this country to bring people up, educate them in a system which is supposed to be fair and equal, and then we don't even know about our own Black British history. Yeah, I mean, they should be heroes. They should be the kind of thing that all people can talk about, Black or white. It's got nothing to do with race, I don't think. I think these are British heroes that should be talked about by everybody, because they embody something really simple, and that's people who want equality. That's all they wanted. They just wanted to be treated the same way. Frank Crutchlow just wanted to run a restaurant. You know, I'm incredibly proud to be Black and British. I think our history is incredible. I think the things that people have been through this country and still kind of survived and come back stronger with so much kind of grace and elegance and smarts and wit and intellect is fantastic, and we should be proud of that.
Lanry, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Steve McQueen's film Mangrove will be shown on BBC One on November the 15th. It's part of a series of five films by the director about black British lives called Small Acts. They'll all be on iPlayer. Frank Scully is currently working on a book about the experiences of black people in the part of West London where the mangrove once stood. For it, he and co-author Ishmael Blagrove have interviewed hundreds of people, including members of the Mangrove Nine. That book, Frontline, will be out next year. My thanks to him, Jeb Johnson and Lanry Bakary. The Guardian is marking Black History Month throughout October. Head to theguardian.com for our coverage. Also, have a look up the Today in Focus episode we made on the Bristol bus boycott, another story about Black British history that many of us had not heard about. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.